Good evening. This is the Voice of America in Washington. Welcome to another edition of Reporters Roundtable. I'm Douglas Impuga. This evening we'll talk about the relevance of the African Union and other regional blocs in Africa. And with us tonight is Fred Omolo, a Kenyan journalist. He joins us by phone from Kisumu. Good evening, Fred.
Good evening, Douglas. Thank you for having me.
You're very much welcome. We also have regular panelist Suleiman Mugula. He's an independent political analyst. He joins us from Durban, South Africa. How are you, Suleiman?
Very fine, Douglas. Thank you very much for inviting me. I'm nice to hear from Fred after a long time.
Thank you very much. Now, gentlemen, as I said, we are looking at AU's role or relevance in today's Africa and other regional blocs. As our listeners may know, there's turmoil in Sudan where there's change of government. Same thing in Algeria. There is the conflict. There is the problem of refugees off the coast of Libya, with many dying every other day, and they are all from Africa trying to flee to Europe. There are threats of Ebola in DR Congo. Then there's the threat of terrorism in Somalia and Nigeria. Now, general picture, gentlemen, beginning with you, Fred, is AU, where is AU in all these problems?
The AU, in my view, is a sleeping giant. The AU is the one important bloc that can actually transform this continent. If you look at the mini economic blocks that we have around here, you have the East African Community, you have SADC, you have all these, you have ECOWAS in West Africa, and recently we've seen efforts to create a mega trading bloc combining all these things. In my view, something like the AU should be the driving force behind such an initiative, okay? If you look at it in terms of peacekeeping, they've done a great job. Kenya at some point had issues in its Somalia border. That was in 2009, and single-handedly moved into the country to restore some order, especially in the region of Kismayu. And then after a few years, it became a very heavy burden, and the AU came in through AMISOM. And in partnership with the UN, they've done a great job in terms of reducing the threat of terrorism in that region. You look at all these challenges, you see the potential of this bloc, but it's not being realized simply because the AU, as currently constituted, consists of at least half of the members are countries that have no regard for their citizens. It's basically governments sitting there. And as long as their interests are aligned with the interests of the AU, then they are comfortable with it. We saw that example here in Kenya when our current president and had an issue with the ICC. And when the ICC journey became a little bit rough for him, they threatened to withdraw members of the AU. So it's a tool. All these countries that have dictators and tyrants and governments that have very low regard for human rights, freedom of trade, freedom of expression, all these governments consider the AU as a convenient tool. They don't look at it as a useful body that can actually transform and take this continent to a higher level. I always consider the AU as something that that is at par with the EU, for example, right? But the problem is the people who are participating in its activities at the highest level consider it a tool rather than a bloc that brings Africans together to pursue the interests of Africans.
Yes, Suleiman, your take.
I also agree with Fred. That the AU, by and large, looks to have died. Maybe we can, for lack of words, say it is in intensive care, but we can't practically see what it is doing. The way you have put it in your intro, you are looking at a continent which is fragile, which is unstable, where there are lots of problems, internal conflicts, socio-economic pressures of unemployment, poverty, pushing young people of the continent moving up and down across the waters, going to die overseas in the Gulf and elsewhere, dictatorship increasing, increasing internal conflicts within. So there are so many things which would have required a body to come up with the policies. When you look at it from, for example, its constitutive act, and you look at the objectives, and for example, Article 3, you find it vowed to promote democratic principles and institutions. You look at the principles, non-interference in member states in internal affairs, which means at one time it is almost contradictory. Though later on in others they say they respect democracy, human rights, and good governance, and the sanctity of life, those are the objectives as you go down into the Constitutive Act. So if you are to judge it from those principles and you compare with what is going on in the continent and ask yourself what have they done and what are they trying to do, then you'll find that they are almost doing nothing. The continent looks to be in autopilot. Since July 2000, a lot has been happening. You just see the absence of power. Zofred has referred to some instances where they have appeared in enforcing some peace in some areas. But even those instances where they have appeared, the countries involved are working as mercenaries. They are appearing there because many of them are there because they are being paid very well by the foreign countries, by the foreign institutions which have come up with these peacekeeping initiatives. Without those countries, without those international institutions paying for those peacekeeping initiatives, the AU itself cannot mobilize resources to be able to run these initiatives. That is why I strongly believe, like Fred, that by and large, the AU has not lived to its expectations.
I see. Both of you alluded to the fact that maybe disparate governance systems may be a factor in that some countries have governance systems that are democratic, while others do not. How big a factor is that? Let's expound on that. How big a factor is that in contributing to the lack of unit of purpose or direction for the organization? So let's start with Fred.
This is all about sovereignty. And sovereignty is, to some degree, surrendering your power at the local level and trusting someone to exercise it at a higher level. And that is what democracy is. Why do you have, for example, a local council representative? It means that you, as the locals who live in a particular neighborhood or a particular ward or particular region, do not want the inconvenience of sitting together to determine how to run your affairs, so you elect someone and trust that someone to do it at a higher level. This someone is a councilman, a councilwoman at a certain level. We also trust another group of people, we call them probably congressmen or such people. We trust another set of people, we call them senators. We trust one person at the very top, we call that person a president. And this president should run a government that is able to donate some of its sovereignty and trust a higher body. That's how you cascade it. And that's how countries that have strong regional, economic, social, political blocs are able to function. If you look at the EU, for example, they have representatives from all over those countries who also come to deliberate. It is a surrender of your sovereignty. And that is, for example, the problem that we have in the UK right now and the Brexit challenge that they are facing. A significant proportion, not everyone, a significant proportion of the people in Britain, in the UK, the Britain and England specifically, they feel that, no, we don't want to surrender most of our sovereignty to a super bloc, a super body, to decide for us how to do things and what to do. And that is the challenge that we have in Africa. It's more acute here because the concept of democracy simply doesn't exist in some communities and countries. It's not even a problem of the government. It's a problem of the people themselves. They don't feel that, you know, let's surrender some of our power. No, it's all about we are the majority. We should decide how things are going. Take, for example, the case of South Sudan, right? You have a very, very significant proportion of, a significant majority of people from the Dinka community. They feel that they should determine and decide how the country goes for good or for worse. They have a facade there of democracy, but they don't really feel like they have an obligation to respect it. You have a significant minority there of the Nuer who feel that, no, we should have an equal representation, equal voice. So they have these constant squabbles among them. How will such a country be able to bring a valuable and substantial contribution at the level of the AU? It's a problem. You get the idea? So that is the issue that we have to address. The AU, in my view, will become a very strong and powerful player across the globe the moment that countries, a majority of countries, significant majority, two-thirds or more in Africa, are democratic. They respect good governance, they respect the rule of law, human rights, etc.
I see. Suleiman, according to Fred, AU will become a strong and powerful player once there is democracy on the continent. In what century would that be?
It is very difficult to determine. It is very difficult to tell. As you have seen, three quarters of the continent is still under dictatorship. The most affected area is Eastern Central Africa, from Zimbabwe. You come up Central African Republic, Rwanda, DRC, Burundi, Uganda, Southern Sudan, almost the whole area, including Ethiopia, Chad, you continue, Cameroon. I mean, a greater part of the continent is still under dictatorship. And as Fred has said, so long as there is no unity of purpose within the country itself, so long as the country itself has not taken off from the power squabbles and it is still involved in two petty issues of who takes which position, who eats more than the other, if the governance of the country has not been settled as yet, then it becomes so difficult for it to contribute to regional or to continental organizations. So the more we have got weak countries, the more we have got lack of good governance in the component countries of the EU, then we are not likely to take a step. That is why the organizations have left the continent in autopilot. For example, sometimes back in ECOWAS, they had suggested to make it mandatory for countries to have two-term limits. It was shot up by the dictatorial countries within ECOWAS. By then it was Liberia, Germany, it was Togo, Cameroon. They made sure that they shut down the idea. So those countries now continue backward and you can't get into purpose in that region. In East Africa, you have got a country like Uganda, whose leader has been in power for over 30 years and generally dominates the politics of the whole Eastern Central African region. It is militant, and in doing so, he's not doing it for the sake of the people within the region. He's doing it as a personal adventurism, as a way to keep himself in power. So you find that area is totally disturbed. So if it is not settled, how will it contribute to the East African community? How will it contribute to any initiative which is brought up, even by the organizations? Like now, we have the East African community. But the countries within them, they are squabbling within themselves. Borders are closed between Uganda and Rwanda. Squabbles over imports and exports between Kenya and Tanzania, between Uganda and Tanzania, and so on and so forth. So unless a step is taken, which should have been the African Union, itself, if it was organized to take appropriate steps to ensure that there is democracy, there is good governance as a priority, as a prerequisite for political and social development in each particular country, then there would be movement. But without anybody controlling the situation, without anybody taking the initiative, the countries will continue to rot and the continent will continue to be fragile as it is.
I see. Well, for those just joining us, you're listening to Reporters Roundtable, and we're coming to you live from VOA Studios in Washington. Tonight, we're talking about the relevance of the African Union and the other regional blocs in Africa. And we have our panelists here, Fred Omulo, a Kenyan journalist, and Suleiman Mugula, a South African-based political analyst. And I'm your host, Douglas Impuga, here in Studio One. Gentlemen, we talk about all this, the incompetence of the lack of cohesion among the leadership of the AU. But then there's the issue of financing. This is the African Union that couldn't even build its own headquarters. This African Union, Fred alluded to the peacekeeping missions. All those peacekeeping missions are funded from other places. We have Ebola crisis in DR Congo, and we had one in West Africa not long ago. All these had to be funded by foreign entities or governments. So how can a bloc or an authority like AU be sustainable when it even can't fund its activities? Fred, you go ahead.
Well, sorry about that. If you look at the challenges that the continent is facing, every time an individual country has a glaring problem, that's when the AU becomes useful for it, right? Now, you do recognize that a lot of the people who fund some of the activities of the AU prefer to use the AU rather than to work with specific governments or to work with non-governmental organizations within the country that is facing the challenge. It says something. It says that, okay, you guys might be disorganized, but at least you have this unit called the AU, which kind of coordinates this, that, and the third. The reason the AU is not getting the requisite funding it needs at this moment is because each and every member only looks to the AU the moment they have a crisis. It doesn't work like that. If you probably know so many cooperatives, farmer cooperatives, women cooperatives, youth cooperatives across the U.S. where you are, across Africa where you come from, where I live. And if you look at these organizations, these small savings and cooperatives kind of units and organizations, it's never about I contribute when I have a challenge. No, it's about support throughout. You never know who is going to be in trouble at what time. If it reaches a point where no one is in trouble, then whatever you contribute comes back as a benefit. So that's the challenge we are having in terms of funding the AU. If we could just have the discipline as African countries to look beyond, to think ahead, and to have that long-term vision of situation, such that if you are, for example, Burundi, and you are currently in a situation where you don't have chaos in your country, your economy is good, democracy is good, everything is going on well, and you're able to make your contribution to the AU regularly, and multiply that by 10, 20 different countries across the continent, the AU will have the resources it needs to carry out its program. And then 5 years down the line, you have a challenge within your country, like happened recently where we had all sorts of natural disasters in southeastern Africa, right? The AU has the resources to respond faster than the UN, the EU, or any of these other people. You as a government might be stable and you'll do your best. The AU will add that extra push. And that is the problem, long-term thinking. And we can never have long-term thinking in countries and societies where democracy and the voice of the minority or the voice of the moderates is never given a chance to speak. So that's the challenge we have. You know, the history of the AU as currently constituted, it was an initiative of Muammar Gaddafi around 2001. Previously, we had the OAU, which went ahead and died a natural death, unfortunately. The driving force behind the AU originally was Muammar Gaddafi in 2001. But he had his own ulterior motives, which was to create a bloc that he could use as a bargaining chip against international powers. Okay? When he left the scene, when he stepped back from the whole AU actualization process, we started having these challenges because this vision was not shared. The vision has to be there in each and every country, and before you participate and contribute positively, you have to be able, as a country, as an administration, as a government, to also have your issues in order. Take, for example, the case of the EU. It's a very rigorous process for you to become a member of the EU, and it takes several years of monitoring and evaluation. Do you comply by this, that, and the third? Fine. You are now part of us. We now have open borders. You now have these benefits. In exchange, you have to contribute this, even if you don't have a challenge. If the challenge arises, everyone will come out and support you. That kind of thinking is what we are lacking.
I see. Suleiman, on that issue of... Strictly speaking, it's not a matter of lack of resources. It's a matter of lack of commitment. You don't contribute your dues, and then you expect something to miraculously to happen.
No doubt about it. The way you have put it, it's not lack of resources. But the bottom line is, the countries are poor. They don't have the resources. They cannot contribute. Why are they poor? There is lack of governance to harness the natural and human resources endowed to these particular countries. If we had countries like DRC well organized, with the proper policies, with no corruption, with no fly-by-night economic policies, I mean, then DRC could contribute even on behalf of about five small countries, almost all the countries. I mean, they cannot produce because many of the countries, the population is on the run. People, ever since the establishment of the EU, as we have been saying, it has been bloodshed, state-inspired violence against innocent civilians from one country to another country. How do you expect them to produce? Southern Sudan, ever since its establishment, you are talking of about almost half of a million people died within the conflict between Salva Kiir and Machar. About 4 million have been displaced. So how do you expect production? The government itself cannot pay salaries for a couple of months to the civil servants who are just even so small. Countries like Uganda, despite the leader even having said for 30 years, almost half a century, is in leadership, they cannot even raise funds to balance their budget. They have to rely on foreign borrowing. Half of the budget has to come from foreign borrowing. So where will they get the money? Go to DRC, go to Central African Republic, people are on the run. So unless there is good leadership, unless the countries settle the question of leadership, like countries like Ghana, countries like Nigeria to a certain extent, Botswana, in South Africa, countries which have settled, and then they start doing economic, social development where they can be able to balance their budget, where they can be able to get to excess funds which they can contribute to organizations like these ones. Otherwise, that is why it is absurd that the AU itself, which is supposed to be at the front line of good governance, which would have benefited them to have a stronger organization and which is well paid, they are not bothered. So they leave the whole continent to be on fire, for people to move around, for people to be brutalized, for corruption to rage, for people to stay in power until when they die. You collapse a country like Zimbabwe, which was a recruitive country, which was even feeding South Africa. Now it is the poorest of the poor on the continent. Countries like Nigeria, countries like DRC, these are disorganized by lack of leadership.
I see.
So that is what we are saying, and that is why we are pleading that there should have been a movement within the continent to start new leadership and to start new initiatives to ensure good governance.
So we're out of time. I'll give a minute to about each of you. Now that most of you are blaming the weakness of AU on the governance systems in the individual countries. Now, what should happen? The AU can't compel the countries, or can't have the drive to democratize the continent. And so what should happen? Is AU still relevant? Let me begin with Fred.
I think that the AU can actually bring some very, very good progress in this continent through a number of very simple methods. Number one, cluster the membership, okay? Who is the most committed and a regular contributor, and who is moderate and who is the least committed? Give that person some kind of reward or benefits for being a committed member, right?
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, identify who funds you, because we acknowledge and we admit that a good proportion, probably 50-70% of its funds and resources come from elsewhere. Who funds you? Is it the EU? Is it China? Is it the ASEAN bloc of Asian countries? Is it the South American? Give these people also some legitimate benefits and some privileges so that they can access trade opportunities, they can access all sorts of benefits for their funding, right? Do a three-year plan and show these African countries within the continent, these are the benefits when you're compliant. Please participate. But if you don't, these are the negative consequences of your participation. Let the AU be a sort of barometer where the UN comes to Africa, it wants to do something, it must pass through the AU.
Okay.
Because of its competence. Mm-hmm. It looks and says, you know what? Mm-hmm. The AU says, I shouldn't come and help you with this kind of trouble because you are a totally incompetent government.
I see.
Raise your standard.
Okay. Suleiman, 30 seconds left, 35 seconds.
The OAU was able to achieve what it achieved because it had some brilliant leaders, some courageous leaders who took leadership and took responsibility that the country had to be liberated from colonialism. People like Nyerere, people like Kaunda, they took a stand. It is high time that we get good people and courageous people in Africa. Leaders, doesn't matter whether from South Africa, Botswana, or Ghana, to take lead the way the Nyereres gave a lead and take a stand that there has to be good governance in each and every country of Africa. There has to be two terms in each and every country of Africa, whether you are so good, but there should be change and exchange of power so that the people can try other talents.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, this road which is on the continent, it needs to be removed. That is why there is a lot of uncertainty. That's why there is a lot of conflicts,
yes,
in many countries,
mm,
and a lot of instability on the continent. So we need the people to take up the challenge of leadership on the continent.
I see. Yeah. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. That wraps up this edition of Reporters Roundtable. I'd like to thank our panel, Fred Omulo, a Kenyan journalist, and Suleiman Mugula, an independent political analyst based in South Africa. And we'll be back again next week with another edition of Reporters Roundtable. A reminder that just in case you missed any or part of this program, you can still access it by going to our main website at www.voanews.com. You can also drop us a line. Our email is reporters@voanews.com. Thanks once again for tuning in. And until next week, I'm your host, Douglas Impoga.
This is VOA News. I'm Jim Burt.